Hello. Welcome back to the Life Divine. We're in the middle of the chapter, The Origin and Remedy of Falsehood, Error, Wrong, and Evil. Picking up the thread, Sri Aurobindo has described how, as consciousness develops in the individual animal being, has to rely on two sources of knowledge. The first is that minimum of intuition. The second is our surface contact with the world. That intuition prompts us, encourages us to fashion together our sensations, what we experience in life, into a kind of working knowledge. And of course, that surface contact is of inestimable value, because without our searching outside of ourselves, contact with external nature, there could be no building of the consciousness. One would be limited to and constricted to one's own formation. So, as he says, the emergence of a surface consciousness by the force of life contacts and the give and take in life is due to the fact that in both, subject and object of the contact consciousness force is already existent in a subliminal latency. So there is the presence of that consciousness force from which the whole universal expression begins. Sat Chit Ananda, but not just Chit, conscious force, Chit Tapas, is here present and supporting every movement of nature, every stirring of sensation and consciousness. That consciousness force is present. It is secretly present. So this secret consciousness renders itself on the surface in our sensations and our perceptions and is a secret impulse behind our actions, leading us from error to truer knowledge, out of ignorance and towards greater knowledge and greater life. So this is the point we begin with tonight, this hopeful sign that even if we seem to be embedded in an unrelenting ignorance, there is a secret purpose behind it, and an eventual dawn of knowledge will come, a dawn beyond what the mind offers us, but a truer consciousness yet. So let's pick our argument up with Sri Aurobindo's passage that begins. If this underlying subliminal consciousness were to come itself to the surface, there would be a direct meeting between the consciousness of the subject and the contents of the object, and the result would be a direct knowledge. But this is not possible first, because of the veto or obstruction of the inconscience. And secondly, because the evolutionary intention is to develop slowly through an imperfect but growing surface awareness. So this easy skip and dance to assure knowledge would be possible, except that the inconscience is there to block it, that darkness at the base of nature, the reflex of what is the superconscious, and also there is a cosmic intent not to have a rapid flowering, but to have a slow evolution where we really have to do the grades, we really have to go through each inning to achieve the liberation that we seek for. He continues, the secret consciousness force, Chit Shakti, has therefore to limit itself to imperfect renderings in a surface vital and mental vibration and operation, and is forced by the absence, holding back, or insufficiency of the direct awareness to develop organs and instincts for an indirect knowledge. So by dint of chit shakti or chit tapas holding itself back, we have to find ways to contact the world, gain access to the content of the object outside, and thus compile data which lead to a kind of knowledge. Thus, the development of organs and sensations in an organized way that we can then deliver them to a mind to interpret, and that interpretation becomes what we call knowledge. This creation of an external knowledge and intelligence takes place in an already prepared, indeterminate conscious structure, which is the earliest formation on the surface. At first, this structure is only a minimum formation of consciousness with a vague sensational perception and a response impulse. But as more organized forms of life appear, this grows into a life mind and vital intelligence, largely mechanical and automatic in the beginning, and concerned only with practical needs, desires, and impulses. So in a couple of sentences, a couple of phrases, he has expressed a whole range of evolutionary life, that which begins in a rather simple way, but then begins to develop a life mind, a mind which operates at the level of the life force, but can, in a sense, reason within its boundaries. All this activity is, in its initiation, intuitive and instinctive. The underlying consciousness is translated in the surface substratum into automatic movements of the conscious stuff of life and body. The mind movements, when they appear, are involved in these automatisms. They occur as a subordinate mental notation within the predominant vital sense notation. So here, mind is subordinated to the vital sensation. It's doing its job, serving vitality. But slowly, he continues, mind starts its task of disengaging itself. It still works for the life instinct, life need, and life desire, but its own special characters emerge. Observation, invention, device, intention, execution of purpose, while sensation and impulse add to themselves emotion and bring a subtler and finer affective urge and value into the crude vital reaction. So here he's describing, again, an eonic evolution, but in a beautiful, simple way. Mind serves life and then begins to build its own powers and takes into sensation the finer aesthesis of emotion. So it's not just raw sensation. We begin to build upon that and to interpret it in finer values. We begin to build, in other words, an inner component to ourselves. Mind is still much involved in life, and its highest purely mental operations are not in evidence. It accepts a large background of instinct and vital intuition as its support, and the intelligence developed, though always growing as the animal life scale rises, is an added superstructure. So, the intelligence as it grows is something that's added to, on top of. There's a basic structure of life, material, vital connection, but on top of that is layered you might say, another floor is added, which is the mind and its capacity to build intelligence. When human intelligence adds itself to the animal basis, this basis still remains present and active, but it is largely changed, subtilized, and uplifted by conscious will and intention. So you begin to see the higher values of consciousness force asserting itself through this lower evolute form. The automatic life of instinct and vital intuition diminishes and cannot keep its original predominant proportion to the self-aware mental intelligence. So as human intelligence, mental intelligence grows, then this power of vital intuition lessens. It doesn't have the force, the strength, the character, the reach that it had in its own field. Now it begins to be supplanted by the mind. Intuition becomes less purely intuitive. Even when there is still a strong vital intuition, its vital character is concealed by mentalization. And mental intuition is most often a mixture, not the pure article, for an alloy is added to make it mentally current and serviceable. In the animal also, the surface consciousness can obstruct or alter the intuition, but because its capacity is less, it interferes less with the automatic, mechanical, or instinctive action of nature. In mental man, when the intuition rises towards the surface, it is caught at once before it reaches and is translated into terms of mind intelligence with a gloss or mental interpretation added which conceals the origin of the knowledge. So here we can see how mentalization dulls the effect of intuition. Intuition is captured by the mind, forced to do its bidding, has to suffer its interpretation. The mind thinks, aha, I have had this thought, and this is what I think, and am I not a bright boy to have thought it? When actually it is a power of intuition that has been caught up and prevented from carrying out its full mission, gets put into smaller cabins by this capturing mind intelligence. So this is intuition as diminished by mind, which won't let intuition function in its full plenary power. Next comes instinct. Instinct also is deprived of its intuitive character by being taken up and mentalized, and by that change becomes less sure, though more assisted when not replaced, by the plastic power of adaptation of things and self-adaptation proper to the intelligence. The emergence of mind in life brings an immense increase of the range and capacity of the evolving consciousness force. But it also brings an immense increase in the range and capacity of error. For evolving mind trails constantly error as its shadow, a shadow that grows with the growing body of consciousness and knowledge. Don't give up on the mind yet. It looks like it's doing dirty business here, but don't give up on it. If, in the evolution, the surface consciousness were always open to the action of intuition, the intervention of error would not be possible. For intuition is an edge of light thrust out by the secret supermind, and an emergent truth consciousness, however limited, yet sure in its action, would be the consequence. That's if our surface awareness could be open to it. Instinct, if it had to form, would be plastic to the intuition, and adapt itself freely to evolutionary change and the change of inner or environing circumstance. Intelligence, if it had to form, would be subservient to intuition and would be its accurate mental expression. Its brilliancy would perhaps be modulated to suit a diminished action, serving as a minor, not as it is now, a major function and movement, but it would not be erratic by deviation, would not by its parts of obscurity sink into the false or fallible. Ah, if our surface could be open, then intuition, instinct, and intelligence would be able to function at a much higher level. He continues, but this could not be, because the hold of inconscience on the matter, the surface substance in which mind and life have to express themselves, makes the surface consciousness obscure and unresponsive to the light within. It is impelled, moreover, to cherish this defect, to substitute more and more of its own incomplete but better grasped clarities for the unaccountable inner intimations, because a rapid development of the truth consciousness is not the intention of nature. So intuition is hampered by the inconscience hold on matter, but also there is another intention in nature than to deliver us rapidly to our goal. For the method chosen by her, by nature, is a slow and difficult evolution of inconscience developing into ignorance, and ignorance forming itself into a mixed, modified, and partial knowledge before it can be ready for transformation into a higher truth consciousness and truth knowledge. Our imperfect mental intelligence is a necessary stage of transition before this higher transformation can be made possible. So we begin from inconscience. We rise to ignorance. From ignorance, we develop a partial knowledge, and only then are we able to transcend and push beyond into a truth knowledge. And so this stage of mental development, its lack of broad acuity, is still necessary, is a necessary link in the chain of nature's evolution. It is, in fact, indispensable. There are, in practical fact, two poles of the conscious being between which the evolutionary process works. One, a surface nescience, which has to change gradually into knowledge. The other, a secret consciousness force in which all power of knowledge is and which has slowly to manifest in the nescience. So you might put them in a different way. First, the consciousness force, which is omnipresent. It is there, secretly pushing itself into manifestation in nature. But the other pole is this surface nescience. Nescience means absence of knowledge, which is on the surface. But what is below, what is behind? There's this oceanic consciousness force. And what is superficial is not the real substance of what nature holds within her. The surface nescience, he writes, full of incomprehension and inapprehension, can change into knowledge because consciousness is there, involved in it. If it were intrinsically an entire absence of consciousness, the change would be impossible. But still, it works as an inconscience trying to be conscious. It is at first a nescience compelled by need and outer impact to feeling and response, and then an ignorance laboring to know. So this is a slow revelation of knowledge possible because of the presence of this consciousness force within. The means used, he says, is a contact with the world and its forces and objects, which, like the rubbing of tinders, creates a spark of awareness. The response from within is that spark leaping out into manifestation. But the surface nescience, in receiving the response from an underlying source of knowledge, subdues and changes it into something obscure and incomplete. There is an imperfect seizure or a misprision of the intuition that answers to the contact. Still, by this process of initiation of responsive consciousness, a first accumulation of ingrained or habitual instinctive knowledge begins, and there follows upon it first a primitive, then a developed capacity of receptive awareness, understanding, reply of action, previsional initiation of action, and evolving consciousness, which is half knowledge, half ignorance. So this contact and friction stimulates the arisal of knowledge through all these stages, which are mechanical in seeming, but which deliver something real and genuine as we move upwards in the chain. Misprision, that word again, means simply a mistake, but it also means an offensive mistake, something that requires a rebuke. It means ultimately failing to value. We see things wrongly, so we assign the wrong value to them. In fact, it means wrong price. We see things and we don't judge them according to what their real value is. So we'll see that word often, and that's what we want to call to mind. All that is unknown is met on the basis of what is known. But as this knowledge is imperfect, as it receives imperfectly and responds imperfectly to the contacts of things, there can be a misprision of the new contact as well as a misprision or deformation of the intuitive response, a double source of error. Ah. So both in the reception and the response to it, we can see things, do things, understand things wrongly, misvalue them, and so compound the nature of the error. So we begin to see just what error leads to and how it is based on this division. It is evident in these conditions that error is a necessary accompaniment, almost a necessary condition and instrumentation, an indispensable step or stage in the slow evolution towards knowledge in a consciousness that begins from nescience and works in the stuff of a general nescience. The evolving consciousness has to acquire knowledge by an indirect means which does not give even a fragmentary certitude. For there is at first only a figure or a sign, an image or a vibration, physical in character, created by contact with the object, and a resulting vital sensation which have to be interpreted by mind and sense and turned into a corresponding mental idea or figure. So, first, object meets object. Sensation arises. Interpretation has to then occur. And then we have to offer an idea based on that interpreted sensation and experience. So we can see we're far from knowledge if this be our operation. Things thus experienced and mentally known have to be related together. things unknown have to be observed, discovered, fitted into the already acquired sum of experience and knowledge. At each step, different possibilities of fact, significance, judgment, interpretation, relation present themselves. Some have to be tested and rejected, others accepted and confirmed. To shut out error is impossible without limiting the chances of acquisition of knowledge. So if we have to go through all of this machinery to gather data and interpret it, we're going to make mistakes. It comes with it, especially if we try to learn largely. If we want to get a full compass of what's out there, we're going to grab at things and we're going to miss. But the consequence, if we don't grab, is that we don't grow. Observation is the first instrument of the mind. But observation itself is a complex process open at every step to the mistakes of the ignorant observing consciousness. Misprision of the fact by the senses and the sense mind, omission, wrong selection and putting together, unconscious additions made by a personal impression or personal reaction create a false or an imperfect composite picture. To these errors are added the errors of inference, judgment, interpretation of facts by the intelligence. When even the data are not sure or perfect, the conclusions built on them must also be insecure and imperfect. So I think David Hume would sign this description of what is the limit of human knowledge, what are the problems of epistemology. This is a pretty accurate description of things, even in terms of modern neuroscience, how we stand away from the object and the various things that we have to go through to contact an external object and build some, quote, knowledge about it, a knowledge which is never sure. Consciousness, in its acquisition of knowledge, proceeds from the known to the unknown. It builds a structure of acquired experience, memories, impressions, judgments, a composite mental plan of things which is of the nature of a shifting and ever-modifiable fixity. In the reception of new knowledge, what comes in to be received is judged in the light of past knowledge and fitted into the structure. If it cannot properly fit, it is either dovetailed in anyhow or rejected, but the existing knowledge and its structures or standards may not be applicable to the new object or new field of knowledge. The fitting may be a misfitting, or the rejection may be an erroneous response. To misprision and wrong interpretation of facts, there is added misapplication of knowledge, miscombination, misconstruction, misrepresentation, a complicated machinery of mental error. And all this enlightened obscurity of our mental parts, a secret intuition is at work, a truth urge that corrects or pushes the intelligence to correct what is erroneous, to labor towards a true picture of things and a true interpretative knowledge. But intuition itself is limited in the human mind by mental misprision of its intimations and is unable to act in its own right. For whether it be physical, vital, or mental intuition, it has to present itself in order to be received, not nude and pure, but garbed with a mental coating or entirely enveloped in an ample mental vesture. So disguised, its true nature cannot be recognized, and its relation to mind and its office are not understood. Its way of working is ignored by the hasty and half-aware human intelligence. There are intuitions of actuality, of possibility, of the determining truth behind things, but all are mistaken by the mind for each other. A great confusion of half-grasped material and an experimental building with it, a representation or mental structure of the figure of self and things, rigid and yet chaotic, half-formed and arranged, half-jumbled, half-true, half-erroneous, but always imperfect, is the character of human knowledge. So, we've done quite a job on intuition, even when it tries to come and assist. And it's only because it assists and insists that we can grope towards a full knowledge. It helps us find our way through many incorrect paths to what is a genuine path forward. So, an errorful mind, this tendency to err, dogs us yet. Error by itself, however, would not amount to falsehood. It would only be an imperfection of truth, a trying, an essay of possibilities. For when we do not know, untried and uncertain possibilities have to be admitted, and even if, as a result, an imperfect or inapt structure of thought is built, yet it may justify itself by opening to fresh knowledge in unexpected directions, and either its dissolution and rebuilding or the discovery of some truth it concealed might increase our cognition or our experience. In spite of the mixture created, the growth of consciousness, intelligence, and reason could arrive through this mixed truth to a clearer and truer figure of self-knowledge and world-knowledge. The obstruction of the original and enveloping inconscience would diminish, and an increasing mental consciousness would reach a clarity and wholeness which would enable the concealed powers of direct knowledge and intuitive process to emerge, utilize the prepared and enlightened instruments, and make mind intelligence their true agent and truth builder on the evolutionary surface. Sounds very promising. But here, the second condition or factor of the evolution intervenes. For this seeking for knowledge is not an impersonal mental process hampered only by the general limitations of mind intelligence. The ego is there. The physical ego, the life ego, bent not on self-knowledge and the discovery of the truth of things and the truth of life, but on vital self-affirmation. A mental ego is there also, bent on its own personal self-affirmation and largely directed and used by the vital urge for its life desire and life purpose. For as mind develops, there develops also a mental individuality with a personal drive of mind tendency, a mental temperament, a mind formation of its own. This surface mental individuality is egocentric. It looks at the world and things and happenings from its own standpoint and sees them not as they are, but as they affect itself. In observing things, it gives them the turn suitable to its own tendency and temperament, selects or rejects, arranges truth according to its own mental preference and convenience. Observation, judgment, reason are all determined or affected by this mind personality and assimilated to the needs of the individuality and the ego. So we see that there is not simply this difficulty of working out of the obscure basis of a surface nescience to deal with. What you might say is the cosmic necessity of fighting out from inconscience through ignorance to partial knowledge and then to an eventual truth knowledge. But now we have to deal with the emergence of a consciousness which is limited in perspective, which cannot regard things except as it affects itself. That is its first insistence and power. What does it mean to me? What do I get out of it? He writes, even when the mind aims most at a pure impersonality of truth and reason, a sheer impersonality is impossible to it. Even the most trained, severe, and vigilant intellect fails to observe the twists and turns it gives to truth in the reception of fact and idea and the construction of its mental knowledge. So every mind is biased, is partial, and cannot arrive at a perspective in the mental awareness which is impersonal, truly impersonal, or which is, to use John Gebser's phrase or term, aperspectival. Here we have an almost inexhaustible source of distortion of truth, a cause of falsification, an unconscious or half-conscious will to error, an acceptance of ideas or facts not by a clear perception of the true and the false, but by preference, personal suitability, temperamental choice, prejudgment. Here is a fruitful seed plot for the growth of falsehood, or a gate or many gates through which it can enter by stealth or by an usurping but acceptable violence. Truth, too, can enter in and take up its dwelling, not by its own right, but at the mind's pleasure. So where we might have error and distortion before, it is with the ego that we have deliberate distortion and the possibility of falsehood arising. This insistence on the ego, insistence on the separate as against the whole, on me versus all others, here we arrive at the beginning of the answer to this question. Where does it come from? We'll go farther next week and we'll start with another examination of the problem as explained through the philosophy of the Sankhya, that ancient Indian philosophy. Sankhya means enumeration. So counting the principles of existence, the various orders of being, one level affecting another, their interplay, etc., all based on the qualities, the modes of nature. So that's for next week. We're getting towards the end of the chapter. The last Sunday before the 21st, I think is the 19th, and on that Sunday we will spend our evening looking at Sri Aurobindo's magnificent small book, The Mother. That evening we won't be working in the Life Divine, but we will resume the week after and then conclude this long but necessary chapter. Tonight, we're going to look at a passage that I think is relevant to what we've been reading. This is in Book 2, The Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, in Canto 10, The Kingdoms and Godheads of the Little Mind. A snake of flame with a dull cloud for tail, followed by a dream brood of glittering thoughts, a lifted head with many tinged flickering crests, it licked at knowledge with a smoky tongue. A whirlpool sucking in an empty air, it based on vacancy stupendous claims. In nothingness born, to nothingness returned, yet all the time unwittingly it drove towards the hidden something that is all. Ardent to find, incapable to retain, a brilliant instability was its mark, to err its inborn trend, its native cue. At once to an unreflecting credence prone, it thought all true that flattered its own hopes. It cherished golden nothings born of wish, it snatched at the unreal for provender. In darkness, it discovered luminous shapes. Peering into a shadow-hung half-light, it saw hued images scrawled on fancy's cave. Or it swept in circles through conjecture's night and caught in imagination's camera bright scenes of promise held by transient flares. Fixed in life's air, the feet of hurrying dreams, kept prints of passing forms and hooded powers, and flash images of half-seen verities. An eager spring to seize and to possess, unguided by reason or the seeing soul, was its first natural motion and its last. It squandered life's force to achieve the impossible. It scorned the straight road and ran on wandering curves and left what it had won for untried things. It saw unrealized aims as instant fate and chose the precipice for its leap to heaven. Adventure its system in the gamble of life, it took fortuitous gains as safe results. Error discouraged not its confident view, ignorant of the deep law of being's ways, and failure could not slow its fiery clutch. One chance made true warranted all the rest. Attempt, not victory, was the charm of life. An uncertain winner of uncertain stakes, instinct its dam, and the life mind its sire. It ran its race and came in first or last. Yet were its works nor small and vain nor null. It nursed a portion of infinity's strength and could create the high things its fancy willed. Its passion caught what calm intelligence missed. Insight of impulse laid its leaping grasp on heaven's high thought had hidden in dazzling mist, caught glimmers that revealed a lurking sun. It probed the void and found a treasure there. A half-intuition purpled in its sense. It threw the lightning's fork and hit the unseen. It saw in the dark and vaguely blinked in the light. Ignorance was its field, the unknown its prize. May knowledge be your field. Delight your prize. Om. Namaste. Jai Ma. Until next week.